Ladies and gentlemen, can I welcome you all to our annual keynote lecture? My name is Graham Thompson. I'm chair of the Royal Television Society for the North East and the Borders. This series of events is designed really to get colleagues in the creative industries really talking about the issues that are facing television and the other media of the day, and we're very confident that you were in for a very stimulating talk and debate, hopefully, afterwards. There will be time for questions afterwards, and we would invite you afterwards to come upstairs and join us for more drinks. But can I hand you over to the Secretary of the Royal Television Society, Tony Edwards, who is our host for this particular event.
Thank you, one and all. Most unexpected, but appreciated, I promise. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. Our guest speaker this evening, Tom Guttridge, rightly deserves the description of one of Britain's most successful independent television executives. And he hails from the North East. Initially attending the Royal Grammar School here in Newcastle, and later the University of York, where he graduated with a degree in English and philosophy. Tom became a BBC News trainee and later the producer of current affairs programmes such as Nationwide, Panorama and Tonight. His range of programme credits, quite literally, is too many to list here. I'm sure he will allude to them during the course
just
of the
too many.
Just too many. too many. An award-winning director, he left the BBC in 1985 as an executive producer and founded Mentorn, which soon became Britain's largest independent production company. Mentorn makes programmes which range from entertainment shows like Robot Wars and Star for a Night, and factual series such as the BBC's flagship programme, Question Time, to popular factual shows like Britain's Worst Driver and Shops, Robbers and Videotape, and landmark documentaries such as Queen and Country and The Valley, which won the Prix Italia. Tom has had a leading involvement with the Television Corporation, Britain's second largest production company, initially as Director of Content and Marketing, and later as Group Creative Director. This was followed by an appointment as Chief Executive Officer, Fremantle Media, North America. Tom has had an array of international awards, including an Emmy for the drama The Bullion Boys, several BAFTA and Royal Television Society awards. Tom was vice chair of the RTS, and indeed that's where I believe we first met, and has been a trustee of the National Film and Television School Foundation. He was also chair of PACT. His spare time, is devoted to enjoying cooking, playing the piano, listening to all forms of music. He has set up the Tom Guttridge Foundation to provide bursaries to enable underprivileged children and adults to improve their education. Ladies and gentlemen, I can think of no more appropriate person to reflect on the current and future state of an industry to which he has made so significant a contribution. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our keynote speaker, Tom Guttridge.
Charming. I don't have to say anything after that. It's really great. It's fantastic. I mean, I love coming. Any excuse to come back to Newcastle, I have to say, is great, especially this week when we have a manager. And Sunderland supporters are here, maybe. But apologies. Commiserations to those people who supported the wrong side. And anyway, we were very excited. Seventh, wow. Anyway, this is the most. Isn't this the most amazing play? I mean, I guess you've all been here before, but I haven't. And I did my A-level revision in the Lytton Phil next door, but I didn't know this place existed. It's fantastic. It actually takes me back almost exactly 10 years to the day, because 10 years ago, I was asked to give the 50th anniversary RTS anniversary lecture, the Fleming Lecture, and it took place in the Royal Institution. So if you can imagine this, but like even steeper and like a balcony as well, and like five times the height, and it was pretty terrifying. But I gave a talk then, exactly 10 years ago, and it was called 50 Channels and Nothing On. And actually 57 Channels and Nothing On, to quote the record, right? And there I just had a look at it, actually, yesterday, before I decided what I was going to talk about today. And I warned of the consequences of not giving producers rights in a multi-channel world. And I called on the government to force the ITV terms of trade onto Channel 4 and the BBC. And I also proposed a very radical suggestion that the BBC reduced its in-house capacity to 50%, creating a 25% additional amount of programming up for grabs to both producers and broadcasters. All of which, of course, has now happened, not because I said it then, but because it was inevitable that it had to happen. So I hope some of the things I'm going to say tonight will happen more quickly than 10 years. And I suspect they will. Because we producers got what we wanted. We wanted all of that, and we got it. So that's it, isn't it? I mean, content is now king, and we own the content, and that's all you need, and everyone can be rich. But is content king, or is it just a pawn in the PAWN, in the new multi-channel, multi-platform, multimedia world? Because I don't believe that 10 years ago anybody, least of all me, could have predicted the changes that actually have occurred in our industry. And all those changes, not just in the last 10 or even the last 30 years, cannot equate to the changes that I believe will take place in our industry over the next 2 years. By the time the border region stops transmitting terrestrially, which is just 2 years from now, we'll be in a new world where there'll be no real distinction at all between programmes made for television and programmes made for the internet, where revenue from downloads will begin to match advertising revenue generated by the initial transmission, where producers will be using television as a promotional tool for content and not as their only source of income, and where viewers won't be viewers anymore, but they'll be customers. So when I look back at the last 30 years, because I am exceedingly old, I look at the television industry with such affection. My world began here in Newcastle with my first ever visit to a television studio, the BBC Studios in Studios. There was one studio. It was called the BBC Studios, but it was one studio. It's very much smaller than this room. In Newbridge Street. From that day, at the age of 16, on a school tour led by the Look North reporter Michael Rodd, I wanted nothing more than to be a television director. So by 23, I was directing Nationwide in London, and I was talking down the line to that very same studio in Newcastle, or more likely shouting at the Carlisle switcher. Now, I assume this was a man, I don't know, but I just assumed it, the Carlisle switcher. His job was to switch the separate sound and vision circuits as they came in from Belfast, Glasgow, Edinburgh, Newcastle, Leeds and Manchester, and make sure the right circuits were routed to our studio, Studio E in London. I also assume the bars open early in Carlisle. Because on the odd night you might get something like, there'd be the vision of a technician in Newcastle with his feet on the desk smoking a cigarette and reading a girly mag, while viewers would be hearing the sound of a very serious debate on abortion coming from Glasgow. You never knew what you got with the Carlisle switcher. But you did feel you were part of a team. A team where everybody mattered. Because in those days, television teams were massive. 7 people on a single camera crew, in ITV anyway. When I shot Fire and Ice, which was an ice ballet starring Torvald and Dean, we took a crew of 130 from London Weekend Television, all the way to Stuttgart in Germany to shoot it. It cost $3 million for 1 hour of video, the most expensive video program ever made. More of which in a moment. And the wonderful cock-ups that we had in those days, they're not matched nowadays. Like in my case on Nationwide, the judge who died live on air. You don't get that things like that anymore. Well, appeared to. It was actually an actress dressed as a judge. And she just slid out of shot as she fainted under the studio lights. And I was 23 and I was the studio director and it was live, of course. I panicked and I said, "Zoom in, lose the judge." And I said down the earpiece to poor old Bob Wellings, remember Bob Wellings, the presenter, and I said, "Keep talking, Bob." And he said, "Oh, I'm most terribly sorry." And he stepped over her. And just carried on as if nothing had happened. And the complaints we got in the duty office as he stepped over the corpse. She was okay, actually. Or David Dimbleby stuck for 11 minutes, terrible minutes, in Studio 3 at Television Centre, a massive studio, with four cameras pointing at him, and all the film had gone down and there was nothing to run in. And all because a man in a brown coat arrived just before we went on air to change a light bulb in the gallery and switched off the mains while he changed it. It's true. Or the disaster in the middle of the Queen's Silver Jubilee celebrations, 1977, never forget it, when the London Centre of Operations, I was 25 then, directed by me, 25, you couldn't imagine it these days, could you? The London Centre of Operations lost contact with the St Paul's Cathedral operation because somebody locked the crew out of the cathedral after lunch, and they couldn't get back in to get to the scanner to talk to me and to tell me that the Queen had overrun her walkabout by 20 minutes. And the whole of the Commonwealth, about a billion viewers, was about to opt in to what they thought was the Queen's speech to the Commonwealth at 3 o'clock. And nobody knew what to do. And all I could offer them was Humphrey Littleton and his band playing live, unrehearsed, endlessly, until the Queen finished her lunch. He was only booked for one number, which he'd already played. And so when the crisis happened, I said to my PA sitting next to me, I said, "Give me a piece of paper quick." And I wrote down, I put on a piece of paper, "Keep going, Humph." And the floor manager went down and gave it to him. And he looked, I'll never forget the look on his face, just off camera. He said, "Is this, And he just started playing for 11 terrible minutes as a billion people watched. We've all had disasters in television. I once directed an opera from Glyndebourne when the star lost her voice completely in the middle. So we put a throat mic on her and she whispered the rest of the recording, just whispered it. It was recorded, thank God. And then we had to try and sync up her voice later and add it later. Why did we do this to ourselves? Why did we suffer so much pain and stress for television? I mean, in those days we got little enough money out of it. No one really worried about who had the rights. Budgets were pretty meaningless. In-house editing could overrun for weeks. I still hold the record for the longest editing overrun at Television Centre. But there were wonderful compensations, being part of a great, loyal, dedicated, focused and highly trained team. There was a time, I actually met someone tonight, Ed, who worked with me on the Hot Shoes show, and it reminded me of the story. There was a time when there was industrial action at the BBC for some reason, I can't remember why, and the management banned all overtime, which was a disaster for overrun specialists like me because it meant we had to stop at 10 o'clock on the dot because they didn't want to pay any overtime to the technicians. So I was shooting the Hot Shoe Show, which was starred Wayne Sleep and Bonnie Langford, so imagine that ballroom dancing thing, but with them really dancing. And there was no way, we had a crew of 80, there was no way we were going to finish by 10 o'clock. So we had a meeting of the entire crew, and they unanimously voted to finish the show. So we got in a few cases of beer, locked the studio doors, Studio One, Television Centre, the biggest studio in Europe. We locked all the studio doors to keep the management out, and for nothing, everyone just kept going through the night. Now that was team spirit. Now, I'm not telling you this because I'm a sad old producer thinking about the glory days, but actually because I was reminded of those happy times. Late last year when I was on a lecture tour in Australia and New Zealand, and I was in Wellington Airport, and I was checking in on a Qantas flight, and this man checked me in, recognised my name, and he handed me a card, after my boarding pass. And he was an editor. The check-in man at Qantas was an editor, and he just bought a high-definition camera. And he's called Virgil, in case anyone's passing through New Zealand and is a cameraman. An amazing way to potentially meet new clients. And next thing, he'll be sort of building a little studio in the terminal to make pilots, literally. But nowadays, anybody can make TV. If Virgil, the check-in man, who was actually bemoaning the fact to me that he was losing jobs to people with real experience. If Virgin the Chicken Man can join the club, no wonder the way looks bleak for the real professional producer, the trained producer. The way that anyone can become a producer nowadays, of course, is one of the production sector's biggest challenges. And it's about to grow completely out of control. A couple of months ago, I joined the 21st century finally, and I bought an iPod Nano. Incidentally, how embarrassing to discover there's no on-off button. Have anyone got, you know what I'm talking about? I spent 3 days trying to switch the damn thing off. It was constantly charging and recharging, with the music constantly playing, until at last I did what any red-blooded male would do. I got my 8-year-old to sort it for me, and he said, just like that, Dad, it's a Mac, huh? Come on. So I bought this iPod thing, and now I know all about iTunes and downloads and podcasts, and I bought a Mac, so I can really enjoy video downloads in all their glory. My, how things have changed in the last 3 months. I'm going to show off now. At the beginning of this year, if you went onto iTunes, you'd see the number one video download was a thing called Photoshop TV, a podcast from The Office of two middle-aged Canadians, graphic designers, with no presentation skills, terrible, terrible production, terrible clothes, terrible production values. And the whole thing had really the worst production values in the world. It's set in their office, which I suspect is one of their homes, because the wife or the daughter kept bringing out cups of tea and coffee in the middle of the show. And you know, it's completely riveting. I got through 4 episodes and suddenly realised I'd watched more Photoshop TV than I had any other series so far in 2006. Now, of course, the networks have woken up to this. And for $1.99, because luckily I live in America, so I get everything half price, I can download the latest episode of Lost, in fact, the latest 20 episodes of Lost, which I do. I now spend more on downloads in a month than I used to spend on DVDs and CDs in a year. Change is happening so fast, it's taking my breath away. In the last 30 years, we moved from cutting 2-inch videotape with razor blades to the Avid. But in the next few months, we'll be watching content on video iPods, downloading it onto mobile phones, streaming it into our broadband-equipped homes. We'll have broadband everywhere. We'll be watching it on I had broadband on the train this morning, free of charge, courtesy of GNER. Planes, in cars, in taxis, on our fridges, wristwatches, in the toilet. There'll be so many platforms, so much opportunity for content. But who will be making it? We, the professionals, or Virgil, the Qantas check-in guy? And who will own it? The content creators or the media owners who have always held all the strings, the broadcasters, the satellite owners, or Yahoo, or Google, or Microsoft? Will content creators now be in charge, like we always dreamed, or will content just be another commodity in the quest by the media owners for profits and survival? Well, that's really what I said I was going to talk about, and I don't think I actually have got an answer yet, sadly, but I'd like to share with you a few ideas of how I think producers might stand a chance of surviving in this amazingly volatile world we find ourselves in. First, a few scary facts. Apologies if you know these. In 3 years' time, more than 50% of the population of the UK will be using broadband. My mum, who is 85, got what she really wanted for her birthday last month, broadband. Thanks to last year's present, which was a Freeview box, BBC Four has already changed her life. She loves the war and she loves Rembrandt. What more can you need? Now she's one of the new breed of grey Googlers. I just hope nobody tells her about iTunes, otherwise there goes the inheritance. Anyway, in Hong Kong, where broadband speeds are really fast, people already use it to watch conventional TV. We're just months away in the UK, where currently we have 70,000 broadband connections a week. More than 75% of internet users locate all their content through search engines. That's how powerful Yahoo and Google are. Already, 60 to 80% of all traffic on the internet is file sharing. Online, considerably more time is spent chatting, that is, emailing and IMing, instant messaging and Skyping, than looking at content. I love Skype. Free calls for life. It's the cleverest bit of marketing. I mean, I assume everyone knows what Skype is. If not, Skype.com, download it. Free calls to anywhere in the world. It's great if you live in two places like I do. And it's the cleverest bit of marketing because it only works if other people are on. So you have to tell as many people as possible. So that's why I'm mentioning it now. So that 3 weeks ago, the chairman of Verizon, one of the biggest phone companies in America, said that in a couple of years, we'll see speeds of up to 3 megabit to handsets and 100 megabit broadband. Wow. Broadband anywhere and broadband everywhere are the latest buzzwords in America. Every single subsidiary of Fremantle Media's huge German operation is now involved with at least one original made-for-mobile project. Scripps, the big, huge US cable network, which owns the Food Network amongst many others, aims to have 10 online channels by next year. They also announced last week that they're about to come into the UK. 3% fewer 16 to 24-year-olds are now watching TV than in 2004, and it's accelerating. And by the way, the average time viewers spend viewing a music TV channel is 4 minutes. Bob Iger of Disney recently said, "We've clearly entered a brave new world where many of the rules of yesterday no longer exist." He's not kidding. So what are we going to do about it? Well, for a start, not bury our heads in the sand. We can either go off and open a bar somewhere, and there are enough in Newcastle already, or embrace this new technology. You see, for content creators, potentially, there's a lot at stake. Terry Semel, the head of Yahoo, said a couple of months ago at the RTS conference in Cambridge, "Owning content, or stuff, as he called it, remains a key to the future, provided it's marketed flexibly and in ways customers want." The key phrase, he said, was "owning stuff remains key." He didn't say "creating stuff remains key." So who's going to own our stuff? He says people are looking at Yahoo as a potential competitor because they want to stream broadband content on broadband. But he says he wants to look at producers and broadcasters as potential partners. He says Yahoo is just an aggregator, doesn't want to be a producer. It wants the license product. So far, so good. But who will he license it from, the producer or the broadcaster? Who's going to be pulling the strings in 2007? Terry Semel, one of the most powerful men in media. He also said some interesting things about content. He said, "When we talk about content, we're going to have to talk about different kinds of content. The content that the professional makes and the content that users make." We're back to Virgil, the check-in guy again. Or maybe Virgil is now a professional too because he's got a business card. So we're talking about anyone with a mobile phone that does video. Because Semel also talked about citizen journalists, like the people who minutes after the London bombings last July started to blog their version of what had just happened and started taking photos with their mobiles. And within seconds, Yahoo uploaded those images. You see, Yahoo and Google have one huge advantage over the terrestrial broadcasters of today, or even over the satellite broadcasters. They have direct personal interaction with the public. And that, ultimately, is what the advertisers want too. So if the broadcasters think that Sky was dangerous, wait till they take on Google. Last October, a consortium of cable industry's largest and most powerful operators in America, Comcast, Time Warner, and Cox Communications, announced that they will combine to sell a new mobile phone service using Sprint's US network. At the moment, in America, you buy your broadband service through the cable companies. Now, you'll be able to buy your mobile phone service through them as well. Sounds familiar? Yes, the recent merging of Virgin Mobile and NTL is one of the most significant news items this industry has had for, well, for at least a few months. Because this isn't, as Broadcast this week got it completely wrong, if you read Broadcast, it isn't about offering customers an additional service or economies of scale to go along with their broadband and cable TV. This is all about control. As advertisers rely less and less on conventional broadcasting to reach customers, consumers, because viewer loyalty to specific channels has now all but disappeared, what really matters is finding new ways of reaching consumers directly. The days of the 30-second ads are numbered, which is very sad because my eldest son has just become a commercials director. I warned him. That's what's behind the Sprint deal, and that's what's behind the Virgin NTL deal. They know that the average family has only one broadband hookup, but three, four, five, or more mobile phones in a household. Mobile phones provide the cable operator with a way of reaching out to their customers, even when they're away from home. So actually what this is about is leveraging the contracts that the cable companies have with the content providers, broadcasters, to get video content for broadband and mobile phones, and in the process, get advertisers back in touch with consumers. That's what this whole thing is about. And for that, they need control of the content. Now, in the US, a lot of producers have been saying, great, mobile phones, here's a new platform. Let's, for the first time, we can make programs and sell it directly to the consumer. It could be the key to transforming us from service providers for the broadcasters into genuine content owners. But not if the broadcasters are simply replaced by the mobile phone and cable companies getting together to corner the market. But sadly, it's too late. They already have, and it started in Britain 3 weeks ago. Now, other ways we can get money out of advertisers to make programs are just about exhausted. In the UK, the broadcasters successfully cut off direct contact between producers and advertiser sponsors. They treated sponsorship as ad revenue and said it was none of our business. But the relationship with advertisers is now both our business and a key to our survival. At long last, way overdue, we're about to get legal product placement onto UK TV. Now, in the US, it's a fairly significant source of additional revenue to the producers, and it's been legal for years. Product integration, it's called. Sounds more polite. Now, all I've said so far may sound a little bit disconnected and perhaps a little discouraging, but in fact, it's part of one big picture. What we used to call television will never look the same again. And for any producers starting or growing in 2006, you're going to have to think beyond what we used to use as our source of revenue. You've got to think beyond the terrestrial networks towards new platforms, new channels, and to the outside world. Or ultimately, your business will not only die, it'll never get started. But actually, if you do, I actually think that the future, particularly in the Northeast, actually, where costs are relatively cheap and ideas are certainly plentiful, I think the future could be very rosy indeed. But to make that future rosy, you need to hang on to the control of those rights. They didn't in America. Amazingly, and very few people know this, is that there's virtually no independent production in America at all. Here's how it works over there. If you have a company, it's unlikely to employ more than about 3 or 4 staff. If you're good and you're successful, you'll be offered what's called an overall deal with a studio, with Fox, Sony, NBC, or whoever. That deal will give you a very big fee, probably a 7-figure fee. It'll pay your overheads and give you a very small share of the back end, which you frankly don't ever really expect to see. I've never met a producer who's ever received a share of the back end in America. Because the studio takes all your rights, all your ideas, everything. There are very few companies which survive without these exclusive deals. As a result, now two interesting things happen in America. One, the producer never has the chance to create any asset value, no real ownership of his own intellectual property. So he never has anything to sell. He can't sell his company because it's not worth anything. So there are no super indies in America. If you give your studio a hit 1 year, you can double your overall fee the following year, and if you fail, then you can open a restaurant. Two, the second consequence is that American producers never look overseas. It's really very interesting, and I think it's a real opportunity for UK producers, which no one has spotted. Before I went to the US, and I've been living there on and off for the last 3 years, I always assumed the reason format sales were a one-way street, that Britain was always the one that sold formats into America, was because, frankly, I thought Americans were less creative. Ridiculous. I thought that. I thought, well, they just don't have the ideas. It's nonsense. It's because American producers have signed away all their rights to the American studios, and because the American studios are only interested in the American networks, because that's where the profit margins are, there's never been an incentive for an American producer to sell an idea overseas. In fact, Americans come up with much better ideas than we do. They're fantastic. Well thought through, considered, relevant, and actually quite spot on for the UK market. But we never see them. Thank God. The American networks spend around $250 million a year on pilots, which will just be thrown away. It's part of the cost of doing business in America. Each network, every year, $250 million down the drain. It's part of the economy of being independent or a freelance in the US that you will spend most of your time making pilots that will never air. And because the broadcaster owns the rights to those pilots will never be offered outside the United States. But now American producers are starting to wake up to the opportunities overseas, and there's a real opportunity for co-development, format sharing, and other types of collaboration. One of the interesting things you find working for a multinational organisation is just how global programme ideas really are. You know the biggest trend in the world right now? It's back to basics. Society has become too complex. The next generation down from the baby boomers, down from my generation, are looking at the mistakes of my generation and saying, why? Why have they made their lives so complicated? Why all the mortgages? Why all the debt? Why all the divorces? The angst. So it's not surprising that creative people who've never met each other separately come up with Super Nanny, all about family values. Wife Swap, all about family values. 30 Days, an American series by Super Size Me, Morgan Spurlock, about what it's like to live in a different society or situation. And precisely at the same time, a drama writer was thinking, maybe I could question all our social structures by stripping away the trappings of society and dump a plane load of passengers on a deserted island. Lost. All the same theme. Now, any of these shows could have been created anywhere. And with the right contacts, producers anywhere could create series ideas with great global potential. I predict in the next 12 months, there'll be shows about ecological issues. It's fairly obvious, isn't it? About debt, how to simplify your life. 36% of all Americans are in debt over their head and can't do anything about it. There'll be more series about how to make your life cleaner, more efficient, more human. America is crying out for good, thoughtfully crafted ideas and formats springing from current popular culture. We can spot changes in and trends in popular culture the same as the next person. We all use the same internet. We all listen to the same music releases. We can follow trends around the world. And ultimately, a successful producer is one who senses the change in popular taste and reflects it in an innovative new format before his competitors read about it in the style magazines. A couple of months ago, as I said, I was in New Zealand and I was speaking at their annual producers conference, their version of PACT. And one of the things I had to do was to chair a judging panel at a pitching contest. And they were really great pitches. And the one that came second, I know, is going to be made into a series over there. I know that because in Europe, Endemol are also producing something that's almost the same format. It's about rubbish. It's on Channel 4. It's about waste and how we waste, and what we waste, wasting it, I guess. Now, Channel 4's got the Endemol show, and nobody in New Zealand knew that because it hadn't been sold into New Zealand yet. The amazing thing is that two New Zealand producers came up with exactly the same idea at the same time. How does that happen? Two people in New Zealand, so remote, came up with exactly the same idea at the same time as two producers from Endemol's creative team in Holland. The answer is that popular culture no longer has any borders. The same thing happens in fashion. Suddenly brown is the new black. Why? It's fashion. Designers don't compare notes. They don't go off down to the equivalent of the Groucho Club and decide what's happening next. Gardening is the same. Amazing. Go to the Chelsea Flower Show. I guarantee you, next month, go to the Chelsea Flower Show, all the gold-winning gardens will have the same theme, underlying theme. One year, it's wildflowers. Next year, it's growing cabbages under your roses. It's the weirdest thing. They don't compare notes. It's fashion. It's completely affected the world's wine industry. What made the tastes of wine drinkers the world over suddenly change in the last couple of years? Before, everyone drank Chardonnay, heavily oaked Chardonnay. Then suddenly, the world decided it wanted something a little cleaner, more simple. Do we detect a theme here? They wanted to clear away the complexity of life, and they wanted Sauvignon Blanc. My prediction, Pinot Gris next year. It's no coincidence that Morgan Spurlock was making his film Supersize Me at exactly the same time that Jamie Oliver was pitching his school dinners concept. They both sensed, and they'd never met, and there certainly was no mention of any of this in the newspapers or any of the style magazines. They sensed that people were beginning to be worried about childhood obesity and fast food, and they articulated it in two completely separate but brilliant pieces of filmmaking. So the trick of being a producer these days, and it makes no odds whether you're in drama or comedy or factual, is positioning yourself at the very cutting edge of popular culture. Surfing the zeitgeist, as Daisy Goodwin calls it. So being a producer isn't about second-guessing the broadcasters anymore, or it doesn't have to be. It's about being at this leading edge of popular culture before anyone else. And then, and here's the new bit, understanding how the customers, because we have to call them customers, not viewers, will want to access it. And one of these ways is mobile telephony. So producers need to look at telephony and new technology, all forms of technology, as serious outputs for your product, because that's how consumers are going to want to access what you make. So think of ways you can make stuff for them. And make contact with the nice people at Yahoo, because frankly, they need you right now. They need you more than you need them. I believe viewers are going to want to watch mobile content in tiny, tiny bits, and it's going to be very special content. If I were adapting EastEnders for the mobile phone, for example, I'd add a secret ending to a conversation which could only be accessed on your mobile. The end of a row or a fight or a confession from a character about what they're really thinking. Secret stuff that customers will talk about at the water cooler. That's what EastEnders addicts will want to buy. Whole episodes, that's for broadband, and the video iPod for the real fanatics. So if I were a producer right now, I'd be inventing amazing stuff, which is specifically designed to be seen while waiting at the bus stop, no longer than a couple of minutes, funny or sexy or surprising. And I'd watch the market very carefully, and I'd see who's buying and how to get into the market. And I'd be talking to other producers in other territories, particularly in America, about how to get this stuff to the end user. The sort of content the world needs now is a bit like the iPod that you can't switch off. Stuff you can't turn off. It keeps popping up on your screen, or like a Mac. Can't get rid of the thing on the bottom line. Sorry, I'm very new to this. It keeps popping up in more and more different applications. It's not a one-off television experience anymore. That world has gone. Forget it. So when your TV series finishes, the really profitable applications carry on because the show is now in popular culture and it's part of society. And the reruns will continue forever on some little cable channel. Now, I get sent program ideas all the time, but right now I'm only looking at content with very strict criteria. One, long-running series, the cutting edge of popular culture with relevance to today's audience. Two, high margin. Three, international potential. And the trickiest is the high margin. But to me, this means multi-application. So I've just bought the rights to one project which has this. It's a great TV concept, which will get people talking around the water cooler, and it'll get the tabloids buzzing, because it's controversial. But it's also a slam dunk as a book, a magazine, and even as a series of live stage shows. It has a central performer. I've already signed up exclusively for the UK. The TV is almost incidental now. And it only cost me a few thousand pounds for the rights, because it wasn't in TV, it was from another world. And it's a darn sight cheaper than running a production company, I can tell you. So I've been watching with interest and amusement the growth of the super indie, given that Mentorn was the first super indie. We've now basically got three models at work in the UK. We've got Grow, a super indie, Mentorn, then RDF, of course. Build a super indie, which is the Shine model. Hire the head of drama here and the head of factual there and the head of documentaries and the head of comedy and the head of entertainment. Get the most expensive people possible and put them in a great big expensive building. Or buy a super indie, which is all three media's route. Well, Grow is cheap, but very slow. Took me 15 years. Build is very expensive. And buy an indie currently costs a fortune. But I think all three models are now flawed. This is a trifle controversial. I don't think they're necessarily fatally flawed, but I think they're flawed nonetheless. That's in case any of you have shares in Shed or RDF. Because the bigger an independent gets, the more difficult it is to retain your creative team. And as I've been banging on for the last 35 minutes, and I've almost finished, because you said, Tony, 40 minutes, and try and bring it out exactly on time. Because overruns are a thing of the past. actually, when I did the Fleming lecture, there was a clock at the back, and the old tradition of the Fleming was you walked in at 7 o'clock and you spoke for exactly 1 hour, and at 8 o'clock the clock struck, and you had to finish by the time the clock struck. So I prepared the joke for when the clock struck and I'd overrun, and sure enough, I did. But I'll finish shortly. The fact is, the bigger an independent gets, it is more and more difficult to retain the team. And we know that content supply, creative content supply, is now everything. We're seeing it already. People are beginning to stream out of the big indies, out of the broadcasters, to set up their own businesses in the outside world. And as more indies consolidate, so that stream will grow into a flood. And if they, those creatives, can now have direct access to the markets which previously only the big indies could penetrate, which they now can, because that market is now available to everybody, then why have a big vertically integrated indie at all? The biggest two challenges facing the independent producer today is not rights ownership, but control of the brand and the retention of the creative supply team. Now, I predict here on the 25th of April, the growth of the Little Indy. And no one said that. I think we'll see the growth over the next 2 years of very small units with focused, content-driven, not program-driven, but content-driven agendas, with great international connections, distribution relationships with a range of platform owners, and a constant eye open for the next big thing. The wise super indies will move out of production and into content ownership, and already you can see that the wisest are looking to more stable forms of cash flow, for, by example, looking at business-to-business opportunities. The super indies are going to have to give content generators more than shares, because who wants shares in a publicly quoted super indie if the price then falls through the floor and it's not your fault? Now listen, what do I know? I'm not a clairvoyant. But I have had the good fortune to have had a year of gardening leave, which ended last week, which has enabled me to look at this extraordinary whirlwind of change from the outside. And you know, I'm glad I'm not starting Mentorn today. Or if I did, I'd do it completely differently. And at least I could now do it in Newcastle as easily as I could do it in London. And to me, that's a huge plus, because you can know your market just as well, if not better, from here. All your markets, in fact, as you can from anywhere else in the UK. And let me end by telling you a little story about how important it is to know your market. I was telling you about Fire and Ice, Torval and Dean, the most expensive show ever made. So there we are, 130 technicians in Germany. It's the most expensive piece of video. The last day arrives, and the head of London Weekend Television, yes, it is he, John Burt, arrives with the American co-financier. We're just shooting the first scene of the day when the American goes white, and then John Burt goes white. John says, "Tom, can I have a word, please?" So I go outside the mobile truck, and he takes me to one side. Michael says, "You can't have buttocks in America." Now, this is a ballet. And there's a group of ice dancers who wear icy things, and they meet a group of fire dancers who wear, well, almost nothing, except a thong at the back. And the leader of the fire dancers is Christopher Dean, the star of the show, and his thong has been very prominent for the entire shoot, and it's the last day. "Is there anything you can do?" says John. "Well, like what?" "Well, like, shoot it from the front." "John, they're ice skaters. They go round and round." "You see his bum about 8 times a second. "And no, you can't do anything in post." And that's why to this day, Fire and Ice, the most expensive show ever made, has never been shown in America. So all I say is know your market. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure you'll agree, a very entertaining and somewhat controversial interpretation of our current industry. As Graham mentioned at the beginning of this, Tom would be grateful and indeed wishing to answer any questions or issues.
No, not wishing.
Yes, wishing. Wishing, Tom. Compliant. Compliant, thank you. We've secured the rights on this, so you're okay. So I would open the issue up to the floor. Could I have an indication of the first question, please? No need to rush all at once. Trevor
Hearing, University of Sunderland. Do you think that the collective experience that excited you about studio production in your first experience when you were 16 or whatever can exist today? Is it not much more of an individual experience now for people in television or in media production?
It's not necessarily the case. I mean, I spent the last year in a company that made American Idol, which is a fantastic, huge studio show, and I love television. I love the smell of a television studio, which is still, there's a sort of scent when you go through the door. Just, there's nothing else. But it is almost completely irrelevant to the kind of programming that largely most people make. And it's a lost art. I mean, it's very difficult to find studio directors today of any standard at all. Almost impossible. to find good studio directors. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, because actually a lot of the studio dramas that were made in my day in the sort of 80s were pretty poor when you actually try to analyse the production values of those great big cameras and, you know, rather sadly trying to do cranes on a pedestal camera and so on. It was all sort of rocky vision and the flats wobbled and so on. It's actually not that golden in terms of an age. But the spirit of production has completely changed. It is now, as you say, much more of an individual art. And I can't say it's a shame. It's just different. It's just, I'm very privileged to have been part of that experience. And occasionally, you get little flickers of it. I mean, I think the producers of the ballroom dancing show, I think,
Strictly
Ballroom, must get a real thrill from doing a show like that. I certainly would. I mean, I did a show called Star for a Night for a few years on BBC One, and that was live, and that was a great thrill as well. But they're becoming more and more rare. You know, finding a studio director for that, there's only two studio directors in Britain who could do that show. Frankly, it's crazy what they used to charge us, because they could have charged us 10 times as much. We'd have to say yes, because directing live, tell you, my son, as I say, he's just started in the industry. He rang me up last week and he said, "Dad, I'm pitching for a rock concert in somewhere over Russia. How do I do it?" Can you believe that? And I think he's going to get the gig as well. He's never done it. So I sort of saying, well, the most important thing is you need a vision maker. He said, what's that person called who presses the buttons? Sorry, Vin, he went to your university.
He's not actually.
But, you know, I said, vision mixer. Now, what's it called in America? Technical director. Yeah, okay. Well, that person, I said, well, they're different jobs. I mean, in my day, a vision mixer would make those creative decisions. You would set up the shots and the vision mixer, and they would just do it. And they were specialist vision mixers. And there are only two left in Britain who can still do this. And I said, you've got to get one of those. And I said, don't bother to try and do the concert unless you can get one of them. Because we don't train people with those skills anymore, because they're not required. Like, it's kind of sad, but you know, what the hell? There aren't a lot of handsome cab drivers anymore either.
Tom, one of the underlying themes of your presentation was the developing technology. One frequently gets the feeling that the consumer demand follows the technology merely because it's available, rather than because of what it is that people want. Is that a fair analogy?
No, it's not. Absolutely not. I mean, anyone who sat there with dial-up for years knows that it's been an extreme frustration, and what you want to be able to do is to have instant downloads and do this and do that, and we're only a quarter of the way there to what we want as consumers. So I totally disagree. There's no question that broadband is a direct response to a consumer demand and not the other way around. And I love the fact that I sit and watch the Daily Show with Jon Stewart every night shortly after it's gone out in America. When I'm in London, I think it's fantastic that I can stay up to date with all this stuff. And I want my broadband to be even faster, please, telling us.
Another question for Tom. Any further questions?
Yeah. Hello, my name's David Reed. I'm from Wellington, New Zealand.
Hello. Have you met Virgil? Well,
yeah, I have, actually. But I'm actually based here now. I work for an advertising agency. We have a television wing. It's interesting to hear you talk so much about new media content, because it's a prime focus of what we're looking at. And I wonder, my one question is very simple, and it's, do you think content is king or are ideas king?
Neither. Consumer's king. No. Neither. It's the consumer is king. I mean, that's it. We're now being driven entirely by consumer demand. The trick is you know, how to market, to place yourself in front of the consumers such that, you know, if you have a half-decent idea, it's going to take off. But now if you do a half-baked idea, it doesn't stand a chance these days.
We have two representatives of our regional broadcasters, Paddy Merrill from Border and Graham from Tyne Tees. Would you like to pass any comment on the ethos and some of the issues Tom has been referring to?
I'd be interested to ask Tom, given the recent Greg Dyke consortium bid, and that ITV remains committed to being a serious producer for a lot of its own content and for others. Interested to hear your view on that, if you were looking at the business from the inside or the out.
What do you think? Can I turn it around on you? What do you think is going to happen on? What's the date of switch off for you in Border?
Somewhere between July, well, the first pass, the Selco transmitter is scheduled between July and late 2008. And
what do you think? What's your prediction of audience share from that day on?
For Border?
Yeah.
Or, it will go down. We may be a little less vulnerable because, you know, we do enjoy a very high, disproportionately high loyalty to ITV.
You do, yeah.
But there's no question. I mean, somewhere between 40 to 50% of the
I thought that's now. Why they chose Border first, because it was the least vulnerable of all the ITV franchises.
There's lots of theories.
Not because it's the smallest, but...
It's because there's no frequency clashes, yeah. Full stop.
But you must know what you expected to go down by. So what's that going to do to your budgets? If Border were, which it is, a microcosm of the network as a whole, what's going to happen to the budget?
It's going to put pressure on them, of course.
Of course.
But it was the producing side of the business, which is not necessarily always predicated on the budgets we, going forward, can afford. If you know, we do have third-party clients.
Yes.
So the simple question is, you know, do you feel it right for ITV, or indeed the BBC, to remain in-house producers?
That's two completely different questions. I don't think one's related to the other. I've always been a huge supporter of the BBC retaining its production core, because I was trained by the BBC, and I've always believed that the heart of production training, which is essential for if we're to have anything that could be remotely called an industry at all, needs a solid BBC production base. And I believe the same thing applies within the ITV regions, so long as we have ITV regions in the way that we do. Is it necessary for the viewers? Probably not at the end of the day, because we'll find other methods. And I really don't think that, you know, in-house production is the sort of issue that it was 20 years ago, when the independent sector first started, and there were serious question marks over whether ITV should continue to have an in-house production arm, or whether actually, you know, when we were going through the franchise round last time, and I was actually chairman of PACT, and I remember meetings saying, well, maybe we should just go for broke. We think we can get these terms of trade through, but maybe we can go for broke and we can get Granada to get rid of its production division, because that really would have made a big impact. And we didn't, and I spent 15 years kicking myself that, as chairman of PACT, I hadn't pushed that through, because I think we could have got it in those days. But now I'm pleased we didn't, actually, because Granada employs something like 1,200 people in the Manchester region, and there's no way, with the structure that we've got now, that the industry will be half as strong as it is without that fantastic production base in the Northwest. I'm very saddened by what's happened in the Northeast. I've always believed that we shouldn't have given up without a bigger fight. And I know a lot of people fought long and hard to retain a proper production base out of City Road. But, you know, at the end of the day, the region just wasn't quite big enough to be able to justify the kind of scale that we could justify in Manchester. But so I do actually think in-house production in ITV is actually rather important, although I don't tell my independent colleagues that I said that.
Graham, do you want to add anything or pass any comment on what Paddy Thomas?
Well, I share Tom's view about the City Road scenario. I mean, I think we were a victim of politics, in the sense that Yorkshire bought Tyne Tees in the early 90s. It needed to cut its costs very, very quickly to pay the enormous amount of money that had been bid for the licences in 91. They weren't going to split production between two sites. It was either going to be Leeds or Newcastle, and you know, it went to Leeds. I think the more interesting thing from a broadcaster's point of view is something you mentioned earlier about the water cooler. You know, everyone talks when the ratings come in overnight about, you know, what everyone was watching, what was the sort of common theme, what is the water cooler moment, you know, are they talking about Mike Baldwin dying in Coronation Street, or, you know, are they talking about something that they've seen on a minority channel? And, you know, if they are talking about something they've seen on a minority channel, who are they going to talk to about it? Because maybe they were the only one in the office that saw it. And I think from a broadcaster's point of view, the dilemma I think that we're facing is, if everyone is going to create their own schedule, how many of the programmes or bits of stuff within that schedule are going to be produced by what at the moment we would regard as the established broadcasters like BBC One or ITV or Channel 4. You know, that, because if the answer is actually not very much, then, you know, we're looking at a dramatically different landscape in a very, very short period of time.
Well, you see, I don't know how you're going to be able to afford to make it. I mean, answer to what we were saying in the first half of your colleague's discussion is that if his revenue is going to go down, but I think it's going to go down, and we won't articulate a figure because clearly ITV knows where it's going to go. In July 2008, just over 2 years from now, where one region suddenly finds its viewing figures decimated, which it will do, what's that going to do by 2012 when London joins the club? Okay? So how can we afford that production base in Manchester? The answer is you can't unless it manages to embrace the new technology and, in a sense, separate itself from its own network. But in fact, ITV's done the opposite. What they've done is they've gone and made the network controller the same person as the person in charge of production, which seems to me slightly short-sighted. I'm sure there are good reasons for it now, but actually, if you think about it as a long-term view, that could well be a fatal decision. I'm not commenting on the reasons why Greg wanted to buy the network, but I don't think it's far behind that thought, actually. And when we, you know, when we get down to it, what is going to... You talk about people self-scheduling. Actually, the way it works, I think, is if you look at the internet and the way people access content on the internet, they don't self-schedule in any normal broadcaster scheduling sense. We're dealing with what I guess the academics here would call communities of interest and intersecting communities of interest. So that example would be, if I say I'm into skiing, which I'm not, but say I'm into skiing, what does that mean? Does that mean I'm the sort of person who goes to Val d'Isère with a group of lads and gets drunk and spends a lot of time in bars? Or does it mean I'm the sort of person who takes my family skiing with other families? Or does it mean I'm the sort of person that jumps off the side of a mountain? And if I were, you might think, well, millions and millions of people go skiing, so let's make a skiing program for that audience. But in fact, that doesn't exist, that audience. And the internet doesn't work that way either. You couldn't make a magazine for skiers, because actually no one would buy it. Because actually, you're not dealing with one community, you're dealing with four or five different communities. And the group who like to go and jump off mountains are actually, when you talk about communities of interest, much closer to the people who want to go hang gliding or the people who want to do other extreme sports than they are to the group of yobs or lads who want to go down to Val d'Isère and get drunk and pick up chalet girls. And so actually, if you look at it like that, as a social demographic thing, which I'm sure they do at University of Teesside and Sunderland and so on, but if not, they will tomorrow. But actually, communities of interest is really the future of our industry too. and it's identifying those communities of interest. So I only really came across, I came across this about 5 years ago when I bought this concept called Robot Wars. And it was a load of geeks in California who built these mechanical things, and they put hacksaws on and chainsaws on, and they fought each other. You've probably seen the show. So I bought the rights to this show, and I thought, and they were very concerned, they said it's a sport. They were really serious about it. It was hysterically funny, because you watch it and it's just these little box tin boxes and hacksaws going and sparks flying and stuff. But they were really serious that this was going to be a world sport. But I bought the rights on the basis of, you know, yeah, I'll develop it into a world sport for you. But actually, I thought it was very funny, and I wanted to make a family show out of it. And what I discovered when the show was made, the first thing I did was to add the house robots, and they were cartoon characters. Because I had an eye, even then, towards the merchandising, and, you know, cut to 3 years later, when the show finally hits the air, it becomes the number one boys' toy in Britain, and Sir Kill-A-Lot is everywhere, and all that sort of stuff. So we had all this stuff designed. The original people who sold us the idea were horrified at what I had done to this sport, and there was, like, hate mail on the web. And, you know, there's a Robot Wars forum, and I was, like, pulled a pillory the whole time. But what we discovered was that we got little kids watching the show, and they would pester the dads to start building these things, and the dads would work with the elder teenage sons to build, and the teenage sons would go to school and pester the science teachers. And it was only when David Putnam approached me and said, this weird thing is happening, and the Department of Education want to talk to you about science in schools because we have to put Robot Wars on the curriculum because we're getting such pressure, that I suddenly realized that we actually had that unique thing of a television show that went across different communities of interest. And that is very, very rare. And it will become even rarer as we go forward. But that you can take any one of those communities, the geeky community, which then got itself into what was the Scrap Heap Challenge, which was derived from it. And then there's the garage thingy show from America, which was copied over here and so on. And all those sort of building things. That's where that community went. Now, that's not self-scheduling. That's just tapping into a community of interest. Now, you broadcasters don't get that, because you don't have to get that, because there was only you. So you had everybody. And so you tap into that so-called community of interest by giving them half an hour a week. And on BBC Two, where Robot Wars was, there was this massive, great, huge curve that if we'd been on ITV, we'd have paid for half the network. From the, you imagine, you know, kids, dads, 18 to 34's highest share on any show apart from Coronation Street. But we only gave them half an hour. Now, well, that's gone. It's gone straight out the window. And they'll find you wherever you are. And they'll find you on the web, and they'll find you on cable, and they'll find you on the mobile phone. And you'll satisfy that community of interest. The clever producer is the person who can see where the communities of interest overlap. So you can actually make a program that, rather like Amazon, when you go onto Amazon and you say, I'm going to buy this book. And then immediately it says, people who bought this book also bought that book. That is what I mean by community. I'm doing a lecture now for University of Sunderland. But people who bought that book now buy that book. And it now overlaps. And that's how you increase your community of interest. That's where your profit derives from. And that's how broadcasters have to start thinking going forward.
Okay, thank you. It's okay. Vinarthi.
Vinarthi, University of Teesside. I didn't teach your son everything he knows. I'd like to pick up, you talked about internationalism, and I'd like you to, and you predicted the future, and I'd like you to expand that a bit for us. The big developing economies, the booming economies, are India and China.
Yes.
They're not worried about obese kids. What do we have to do as program makers in that international world?
Do you know, I don't know the answer, and I'd be a lot richer if I knew the answer then. But I think it's a really, really, really interesting marketplace. And if we're going to get in there, we have to do it through a series of partnerships and collaborations. Because I do believe that you can only be a producer by getting at the cutting edge of popular culture. And if you don't understand the culture, you can't begin. And it would be grossly arrogant of me to be able to say that I could predict for 1 second what China's going to want next month. All I know is we did sell Robot Wars to China. It did incredibly well. And there was something kind of universal about building something from scrap and building something from whatever at that time. And I would be very surprised if some of the events I've read about, I don't know if they're true or not, about China, the government in China in the last 2 months starting to say, well, hang on a minute, let's get our priorities right. We're building all these things, but what about the rural workers and what about some of the traditions we're leaving behind? Isn't in some way connected to what I'm talking about getting back to family values in the West. I just suspect they are. I don't know, but I suspect they are in some way connected because I do think these trends are global.
Thank you. Gentleman here.
This question will betray the fact that I'm not from the industry that you represent so admirably tonight. But I wonder about public service broadcasting, in inverted commas, in the world that you describe, with a different relationship between the customer and the producer and the distributor of these kinds of media.
Well, if I could separate that from the discussion about the BBC, which I'm totally ill-equipped.
Yes.
But actually, it ought to work rather well, shouldn't it? I mean, let's go back to my mother, 85. She was given her Freeview box for her birthday last February, and now is probably... makes up quite a proportion of BBC 4's viewing figures. And if anyone demonstrated the way in which the public can react and be satisfied in terms of public service broadcasting, it's my 85-year-old mother and what BBC 4 is providing to her. And the fact that she wanted broadband because she happens to have a Rembrandt thing right now, and said, it's taking too long to download the pictures from Amsterdam. She thinks it all physically comes down the pipe from Amsterdam. So I'll get you broadband. Actually, illustrates to a certain extent that public service broadcasting is all about direct-to-consumer stuff. Because that's what public service broadcasting is. And it's ensuring that the minority interests are catered for, and if anything can cater for it, it is the multi-channel environment, which, with great respect to our colleagues from ITV, they could never do satisfactorily because they were always going for the broad audience. And the moment you think about the world like you think about the internet, think about the world of television, the way you think about the internet, and you think about communities of interest and how do we serve them, suddenly public service broadcasting becomes very clear. Becomes then, the next stage of that is actually becomes rather more difficult to justify a BBC monopoly in that, because lots of people could spot all sorts of public service opportunities and not necessarily emanating from an office in television centre. But that's a different debate, and it's being had right now at the Royal Television Society in London with Mark Thompson speaking.
Tom, could I just go back briefly? The model of the web access, it's largely noted for its deregulation.
Yes.
Does that offer you any concerns in terms of the content level?
No, I don't know. It doesn't, actually, because I think that the web is starting to regulate itself rather well. Don't you find that? I think that Yahoo and Google almost going too far on that way. I mean, what's happening in China at the moment is a good example, is it?
But that was a commercial imperative rather than a consumer.
It was, but you can parallel it to a moral imperative too. I mean, it's the same argument really.
Okay.
At the end of the day, so it doesn't actually worry me. I mean, I don't think deregulation as such is anything to be feared. You know, we know that the pornographers are going to lead the way in terms of finding new technology and new financial models, because that's always happened. I mean, the video industry was driven by pornography, actually.
Yes.
And feature film followed on, and the same thing has happened on the web, and the same thing's going to happen in new technology and mobile telephony and so on.
It is an interesting side issue that when Tom first explained the title of this presentation, Content, King or Porn, I did ask him to spell porn. Ed, you wanted to raise an issue.
Ed Pugh, freelance producer. Just interesting, in regards to the BBC, Mark Thompson is obviously really excited about the potential of iPod TV and your personal players.
fits rather well what he's saying right now.
Yeah, and I can see that huge potential. Where does that leave the license fee in the future? Because if they are consumers, they can consume it and pay for it. Does it mean the license fee will erode away? And also, just as a kind of add-on, would you advise your 8-year-old to go into TV scheduling?
Well, the answer to the second question is no, because my children are more creative than to be schedulers.
I'll escort you out, Tom. You're okay.
The real question being, is the schedule dead?
Of course it's dead. It's been you know, it's now a marketing department. It's not a scheduling department. And marketing is a much bigger art than the chess playing of what you put up against what other program. What was the first part of your
question?
Should it be suspended?
Well, it depends if you want my mum to be happy. Because my mum and the 10,000 or so, or 20,000 or so other viewers to BBC4 could not support by advertising on her pension the programmes that she currently watches. And that is a political decision at the end of the day. It's not up to us. I'm actually very comfortable with paying what we pay so that people like my mum can enjoy programmes like that. And I'm very comfortable with the value for money that we get from the BBC. I think it's far too big. I think it's been allowed to expand too far. But that's, you know, the licence fee could be lowered if it did less, clearly. But, you know, I come up against the sight of my mum watching her Rembrandt programmes, and I think, actually, at the end of the day, that's what it's all about.
Are there any last final questions or issues anybody would like to raise? Garth Jeffrey.
Somebody used to sit in Newcastle Control Room at the other end of the Carlisle Matrix. I remember Nationwide very well.
Yes.
All sorts of weird stories. How local can local television realistically be?
Well, I think it could be a lot more local. A lot more local. And I don't know what we're doing wrong. Are you an advocate of local?
I've watched what's been happening. I know there's an experiment going on in West Midlands that the BBC is doing. But it interests me what you can actually do.
Well, I don't know what can be done technically, but I'm fascinated by this. I really am. On Good Friday, they shut down the street in Hampstead, where I live, outside Marks and Spencer's, and we all thought there'd been a murder in Marks and Spencer's. And they shut down the street for about 2 hours, and my girlfriend, who comes from Los Angeles, said, well, it'll be on the telly, and she put on, bless her, put on BBC One. And I said, what are you doing? She said, well, because it'll be on the telly, won't it? They've shut down the street for 2 hours and there's people everywhere. And now in America, local telly works, actually. And if you see a helicopter flying overhead, you know it's pretty certain it's going to be a news crew filming a traffic accident or a robbery or whatever. And, you know, in terms of journalism, it's all rubbish, of course. But you do get a sense of local telly, even from the big networks. And the networks, you constantly get a, you know, lower third saying, breaking news, there's been, you know, a problem on the 405 or whatever. And I just don't think we've ever got it right. And it's partly because nobody's ever sat down and thought what local telly is all about. I remember a terrible conversation I had with John Burt when I was chairman of PACT, and he'd first become the DG, and I was a great advocate for regional TV, because when I became chairman, they said to me, you've got to have a platform, even though you're going to be elected unopposed, because it's the way it was done in those days, probably still is, you've got to say what you believe in. And I said, well, I believe in two things. One is tax breaks for the film industry. Let's transform the film industry, which we got eventually. And the second thing was a regional quota. So I went in with that remit for regional quota, and I started talking to. Sorry, I went to see John Burt. Hey, it's Tom here. We're packed. You do this, and I just never forget him saying, it is not our function to do regional programming. Those are his very words to me, and I've never forgotten. And I started in regional television. I started here in this city. And I've never believed it, and I don't believe it to this day. It's an area that still fascinates me. He said, it is the function of ITV to provide regional programming in Britain. He said that, and he was the Director General. Isn't that amazing? And I said, so what is your regional policy? He said, no, we are going to invest in regional news. Now, what happened?
Why was the road closed outside Marks and Spencer?
A man got run over by a bus outside the hospital and died in the hospital, and they wanted witnesses, if you want to know. Well, it's really boring, but...
No, it's fascinating.
I love the technology. You know, you need...
Tom, on the model in relation to Garth's question, though, hasn't local radio got it right in that context?
Well, nobody listens to local radio. Nobody at all listens to local radio. They don't. Nobody does. Nobody does.
Can I just do a quick straw poll in this audience? How many people listen to a local radio station? You rat. You Can I have the next question, please? Any more questions?
I'm only being controversial.
Yeah, I'm sure you are.
It started here.
Right, I think it... Oh, sorry, Trevor, again. Two for the price of one, Trevor.
Do we need commissioning editors at all? If I have a website in which I can put on my programmes about sailing or whatever it is...
But how are you going to get it publicised? How are you going to get it promoted?
Yeah.
You see... This great debate about which is more important, the network or the brand. Which is the brand? And in America, it's extraordinary, actually, as a comparative model between the way digital is working, or cable and digital is working in America, and the way it happens in Britain. It's completely different. In America, you've got Fox, and you've got FX, which is their cable station. It's not called Fox 2, it's called FX. And has a completely different commissioning team, completely different budgeting team, utterly different priorities. It's an upmarket, upscale, very thoughtful cable channel that produces fantastic quality drama and fantastic quality factual programming and entertainment programming. Whereas Fox is much more downmarket, much more... They're doing two different things, and there's no relationship between the two of them at all. There's no cross-promotion, there's no repeats off one onto the other. There's no... Yet in Britain, there's... How many ITVs do we have now? Is it four? And what do they all do? I don't know. There's a viewer, ITV... I can't tell. Can you tell? I can't tell the difference. Sorry, guys, but I can't tell the difference between ITV 1, 2, 3, and 4. They're all... Because you only get one word on your thing on my Telewest thing. You get the program name is all you get. You have no idea what it's all about. I think we've got it completely wrong. Both countries have got it completely wrong. But at the end of the day, you will get an expectation from certain channels, and the scheduling process, you know, does it work? Well, there's a lady called Nancy Dubuque who sits in New York, who was given the unenviable task of commissioning shows for a network called A&E, Arts and Entertainment, which used to be the network that carried all the BBC repeats. And she was given this job 2 years ago. And she thought, well, can't get much worse than this. I mean, nobody's watching the network. We have a biography bit, and we still run a few documentaries and stuff, and we have very heavy dramas. So I'm going to have fun with this commissioning job. And she commissioned the Gottis, you know, the mafia gangster's daughter, and commissioned a reality show. And it became a massive hit. And she saved the network, one commissioning editor. Because viewers actually are much more intelligent now than they used to be. They used to sit there, and my mum used, on principle, never to watch ITV. Just on principle, would not watch ITV. I don't like ITV, she would say. Now, viewers, they're now in control. So they've switched on their millions to the Gottis. And that one series paid for the entire network, so that Nancy Dubuque became a heroine. And she can do what she likes on the network now. And she's commissioned show after show, hit after hit, because she spotted certain things about popular taste and popular culture that no one else had spotted beforehand. So commissioning editors are going to be more than important. They're going to be everything if networks are going to have any meaning at all. And one of the problems, bless them, on ITV, is that you haven't had a Nancy Dubuque commissioning for many years. And ITV has become staid, predictable, dull. You don't know what it stands for. There's nothing surprising. And it shows. Reason number two why Greg wanted to buy the network. It's true. You know it's true.
Right. We'll just pause to draw breath on that one, I think. Are there any other issues or questions anyone would like to raise?
Paul.
Yeah.
You've obviously had about 30 years' experience. For someone starting off now, obviously with all your experience, what do you wish you would have known when you were starting off?
That actually nothing. I had the best possible start anybody could have. I was trained by the BBC. And there's no better start. So I wouldn't have done anything different than what I did, I'm afraid. But I don't know what the BBC does in training these days, but there is probably not even as much as it was doing then, which wasn't a huge amount. But I do think that was the best possible start. And I worry for my son, who's sitting in Barcelona, becoming a commercials director in a world where 30-second commercials are disappearing. And but you can't tell him, can you? He's 24. How old are you?
24.
There you go. So whatever I say, it's not going to go in, is it?
Okay, do you want to write a reply to that one, Paul? Okay. I think it has, regrettably, Tom, come time to bring to a conclusion. I think one definitive measure of the success of tonight's presentation is Tom spoke for approximately 40 minutes, but has answered questions far in excess of that, which I think is a tribute to both your presentation.
I spoke for exactly 40 minutes.
No, that can't be a bit past that. But I'd like on your behalf to thank you most sincerely for the time, effort, and indeed for your innate knowledge and expression of interest in this dynamic of industries we are all interested in sharing. On your behalf,
thank you very much.
Tom.
I should have told you at the beginning that if the fire alarm rings, everyone's going to get out. So, at least you now know. Thank you for attending this. I think this has probably been one of our most stimulating events in the sort of keynote lecture series, Tom. Sitting here, as I do with my ITV hat on, it is a challenging future facing us, not only in the region but also nationally. But I think just to pick up on one thing which you said, which I think should galvanise people in the Northeast, because we had Kate Stross from the regulator come and talk to us about a month ago, and she said the one thing she slightly worries about is the fact that there is not a critical mass in the Northeast. In terms of her production review, where she's talking about whether or not there should be centres of production outside of London, which Ofcom believe there should be, but which of those centres are they going to support? They will clearly support Manchester, they will clearly support Leeds. Might they support Birmingham? They might. Might they support the Northeast? The Northeast, she thought, didn't have the critical mass. And I sort of agree with you that the future is not necessary. And when she was talking about critical mass, she was talking about the super indies. You know, there is no RDF in Newcastle. There is no Tiger Aspect in Newcastle. Actually, the number of small companies that are carving out a niche for themselves in a very competitive marketplace by doing the very thing that you're saying about knowing the audience and being able to not only market it in television but also to find other platforms actually is what we're quite good at. And so I think there is cause for optimism up here. There is also the question of local television, where you think about what really matters to you when you turn the TV on. Is it the fact that George Bush is sort of ranting about Iran, or is it the fact that there has been a major accident on the A1, which has meant that traffic's at a standstill, people can't get home? It's the things that matter to you, I think, in local terms, which as we get more global, will become more important. And I think that's why I share your enthusiasm for local television. I just worry about who's going to pay for it. But on that note, can I echo Tony's thanks? It's been a great night. Please join us upstairs for a drink. If you want to join the Royal Television Society, do talk to one of us. It's an excellent organisation to be part of, and you could be coming and watching things like this on a very regular basis. We will be getting in touch with members and supporters about our awards event, which we're going to change quite dramatically for 2007. It'll be the 2006 awards, but it will be in 2007. So we'll be getting in touch with you all about that. Can I just end by again asking you to thank our excellent guest, Tom Guttridge.